Like, even before we got the diagnosis, my husband turned to me and was like, why can't anything just be easy for us? Every step of the way, it's always been something. And now it's a rare genetic disorder.
Hello, you're listening to The Rare Life. I'm your host, Madeline Cheney, and today I have a story episode with the lovely Annie Kuo. In this episode, Annie shares her story, which actually starts with years of infertility, which eventually led to the birth of her 15-month-old twin daughters, one born healthy and the other born with Prader-Willi syndrome. She shares the way the years of infertility impacted her experience of learning her daughter's diagnosis, as well as what it's like to watch her non-disabled twin, Sophie, reach milestones with relative ease while Kenzie has to work so hard for everything that she does. One example of that is the way Sophie eats compared to how Kenzie eats. It is wild to me how even the most basic and yet important things like eating can be so impacted by medical complexities. Annie's daughter, Kenzie, is tube-fed, as I'm guessing is the case for the majority of you listening today, or perhaps that was the case and no longer is, as is true for my family. Navigating tube feeding and feeding therapy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, on top of everything else can be so stressful, especially when our children are struggling health-wise and their bodies need all the help they can get from proper nutrition. The company, Functional Formularies, understands the importance of access to high-quality nutrition very well. They create blends of carefully selected organic, plant-based foods that children can consume via feeding tube. They are stored in shelf-stable pouches for optimal convenience, which, let's be honest, is a very big deal for this community. Their product, aptly called Nourish, has 14 carefully selected ingredients, each ingredient chosen for specific health benefits. And it is free of the top 8 allergens and has no artificial ingredients or sugar. And honestly, you might be surprised at how rare that is in a feeding tube formula. And I mean, if we're being totally honest, kids being fed with the formula Nourish are eating far better than most of us listening today. It is amazing. And as we all know, special formulas can get expensive really fast, as we all know, and as Functional Formularies is well aware of. But they want everyone to be able to access the goodness of their formulas. So they have a team member dedicated exclusively to helping you navigate insurance if you need a little extra help. There is a pretty high success rate of getting coverage, which is really awesome. Just make sure you keep your child's clinician in the loop during the process because they will require a referral. If you are interested in trying the formula out before getting into Mama Bear or Papa Bear mode and advocating to get it covered, you can ask your clinician to request a free sample from Functional Formularies. There is a link in the show notes for them to do that. If you would like to learn more about Functional Formularies, check out their website, functionalformularies.com. Again, that's functionalformularies.com. There's a link in the show notes if you'd rather just follow that. A huge thank you to Functional Formularies for creating a product that can give us such peace of mind and for making this episode possible. All right, guys, a little update about our Family and Friends Rare Disease Day fundraiser. As many of you know, we are already halfway through with one more week to go. Together as a community, we have raised 85% of our goal, which is seriously so exciting. But the donations have definitely slowed way down now that it's been a whole week since kickoff. We need your help to get all the way to our goal. Rare Disease Day, February 29th, is the last day to participate, but there is still plenty of time to do it. So if you haven't yet, do not despair. I am so grateful to every single person who has joined in the fundraiser already or will do this week in whatever capacity you feel able to. So as a refresher, instead of placing large financial burdens on the parents in this community, since we know having a medically complex child can be extremely expensive, we are counting on your circles of support to donate on your behalf to help the Rare Life continue to function and create meaningful episodes like today's, as well as other resources. This can be a really meaningful way for your friends, siblings, parents, neighbors, coworkers, grandparents, to show you some love by supporting us so we can continue to love and support you. Every dollar means so much and adds up really fast. We are asking those of you on Instagram and or Facebook to create fundraiser posts there on behalf of The Rare Life. You just search our name and it will pop right up. Then it will give you a spot to share what The Rare Life has meant to you. We've seen some really great success there. You may be surprised who shows up for you in that way. We're also asking listeners to reach out directly to those closest to you via email, text, phone call, or in person, and to send them a link to our donate page while also sharing what The Rare Life has meant to you. And I will throw in one little tip there. If you feel uncomfortable reaching out to someone like one-on-one, throwing the link to donate in a group text or a group chat can make it a little less intimidating if that makes you feel uncomfortable. If you want all the nitty-gritty details and some hand-holding on how to do these things, as well as examples of how others have done it, you can go to the website, therarelife.org/fundraiser. I know you guys are some of the busiest parents on this earth, so like I said before, every single effort means the world to us. It really does. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Okay, a little more about Annie, and then we'll hop right in. First of all, as you'll hear a bit about in the episode, and as some of you already know, Annie is one of our fantastic discussion group facilitators. Discussion groups are kind of like a book club, but instead of discussing a book you all read, you discuss the most recent episodes of The Rare Life. And also like a book club, you inevitably end up talking about things that are completely unrelated to the topics and leave feeling understood and uplifted. They are every 2 weeks, and our next one is Tuesday, March 5th. There's one group that meets at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time and another one at 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. There is a link to sign up in the show notes. Annie is an integrative family medicine physician. She, her husband, and daughters live in Los Angeles and is a lover of her dog, Zoe, and of listening to audiobooks and then giving her husband a detailed recap. All right, let's dive in. Hi, Annie. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Madeline. I'm so excited to be here. I've been listening to your podcast for like the past year because I've only been in this like rare disease world for a year now. Everyone on your, like you, your team, everyone that's on your show, all the contributors and guests, like everyone's like my superhero. So like, I'm so deeply honored to be able to support, you know, this show and you and the community, and then also to be able to share my story. So thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I love that so much. Well, it's so fun because since you're a facilitator for our discussion group, shout out to discussion groups. Everyone needs to join those. We have a group chat there like for the facilitators. And it was so fun because after I think it was like the first couple of the meetings, and I'm not there, like I don't go to them. But after the first couple meetings, like every facilitator was like, you need to interview Annie. She has such great stuff to share. And so I'm like, this has definitely been down on my list for a while. So I'm really excited to talk to you because you do have a unique perspective and stuff to share. So
thank you for sharing that with me. I had no idea.
Okay. So I would love to start out. Obviously, your story starts before conception, before pregnancy. Like that's usually where these stories start, right? Or either like during pregnancy, at an anatomy scan, or like shortly thereafter or years after. But for your story, you know, it started years before that. So would you mind starting like right at the beginning of like when you wanted to have children?
Yes. Thank you for asking that. Yeah, I absolutely agree. That's really like when our story of like Sophie and Kenzie started. My husband and I started doing this in like 2013, you know, so like 10 years ago. And I didn't know anybody that had infertility issues at the time and, you know, had no reason to suspect that I would too. And my husband would too. And in my medical training, it was like really barely touched upon. And so we started trying and, you know, we didn't get pregnant and then moved on to IVF. And we had like a particularly complex like IVF journey that was just like so much loss and so much like bad luck. And like, you never want to be interesting to doctors, right? Because that means they've never seen this before. And you never want to be a surprise to your doctors either, right? Because they're like, you know, they expect, you know, they have so much knowledge and experience and they expect X, Y, and Z to end up with this result. And when it doesn't happen, you know, it's, you never want to be in that position, but that was definitely us. So it took us 7 years to finally have our babies. And in that time, we really had to think real hard about like, you know, why do we want to have children? And also like, did we want to keep going? Because there was just so much like loss and disappointment and sadness and grieving and trauma.
Well, and for those who are like involved at all in anyone's life who's done IVF, or if you, you know, people listening who have done IVF, like 7 years of that. I mean, that really is hard to wrap your head around, because like IVF is so intense for a lot of people, for everyone. It's this emotional journey, a physical journey. And so like that just blows my mind. Like that is such a long time. And it sounds like it was full of a lot of heartbreak and loss. And like you say, it probably was very tiring, like where you're evaluating, like, can we keep doing this?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, like acknowledge that we had a lot of privilege going into this, right? Like IVF is expensive. We were fortunate that we had some insurance coverage that was super helpful. And, you know, we like had a little bit of a cushion, like financially, right, to keep going. It did really force us to like, what's our why here? Doing it just because everyone else does it is not a good enough reason anymore, right?
What would you say was your like core reason? Like, this is what keeps us going and why we're continued to seek that and to try to grow our family.
The main reason for me was like, I wanted the experience of parenting with Ray, my husband. And I wanted to go through all the stages of like birth, childhood, adolescence, and then adulthood, like with him, and to like just like experience all those phases of life with a child that was ours. And so, you know, like part of that process didn't involve me thinking, okay, well, like if we don't have children, would I be okay with like, okay, maybe being more involved with like the other children that are already in my life, like my friends' kids. For me to keep going, I had to acknowledge and be grateful for like what we have and not just focus on what we don't have, right? Because I think that's the part. For many years in our IVF journey, I was so focused on what we don't have that drove me, but it drove me from a place that was very like a lot of sadness and disappointment and heartache and like trauma, you know? So when I started to really focus on like, okay, you know what, like my husband and I, we have an amazing life together. We really do. And we have so much to be grateful for. And like, yes, we still want children, but you know, if it doesn't happen, I know we're going to be okay. There's definitely going to be more grieving that I'll have to like work through, but I did know ultimately we were going to be okay.
Well, I feel like that is such a awesome like precursor too, to like fast forwarding to once you did have the twins and you found out one of them has medical complexities, where like, you know, we have like our little notes jotted down of what you wanted to discuss today. And one of those things was like feeling the gratitude and the grief at the same time. And it sounds like that's exactly what you were experiencing before you even became parents to them. And so I just think that's a really beautiful like beginning to that experience, where you've already experienced that deep grief and longing and gratitude that like a lot of people don't experience, which I think, you know, again, it's like foreshadowing to what happened later for you guys when you did become parents.
Yeah, absolutely. After we got the diagnosis, you know, I definitely went through like lots of deep, deep self-pity. Literally like sat and like mentally made a list of like all the things that have happened in my life that have gone wrong and like all the things that were terrible, right? But our IVF journey, it got so hard and so challenging and like so long, right? That like the last few years, I finally decided to make my mental health a priority. And part of that was doing the work and like training up different emotions and like just having more awareness around my emotions and learning a little bit more about like coping skills that work for me. Even though I made that list like of all the things that have gone wrong in my life, but I made that list at the same time knowing like all of these experiences that I've had, they're also like all experiences that like I've learned so much from each one. And they've all given me the tools that I need to like be a really like badass, awesome mom to a like medically complex child, and be a really badass mom to like my typically developing child too, who I know is going to, you know, be influenced by all these experiences.
That's so powerful. Okay. So like, I'm so curious, when did you find out that, well, okay, first of all, we need to hear like the joyous moment of finding out that you were pregnant. And then when you found out there's stuff going on with Kenzie medically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Sophie and Kenzie were carried by our amazing gestational surrogate.
Oh my gosh.
They were actually our 8th frozen embryo transfer. So the first 4 we tried with me, and they either didn't like implant at all or I would miscarry at about 7 weeks. And then so we, you know, did move on to connecting with a gestational surrogate. So she was the one that carried them. And the pregnancy, like, honestly went like really well. And so we had untested embryos, you know, but not really a concern to any of our IVF doctors, because like all of our like pre-genetic screening was normal. And so we just did, you know, the like typical like NIP testing. There are a few genetic variations that can cause Prader-Willi syndrome. The variation that we have is not detected in the NIP testing. our like anatomy scan was normal. You know, usually a lot of IVF pregnancies will see MFM plus, like, given that these embryos were made when I was 41, we are considered a high risk pregnancy. So our MFM was like, you know what, like, I don't think you need to do an amniocentesis. Everything's looking great. So we, you know, opted for not having one. And I would say, like, throughout the pregnancy, I feel like we've been playing this, like, terrible game of, like, IVF, like, bingo, where it's, like, all the terrible things that can happen that can go wrong with IVF have happened to us. And, like, I definitely thought about, like, huh, you know, we've never had, like, a rare genetic disorder pop up on our bingo card, or we've never had, like, a congenital defect or, you know, something that was, like, medically, like, complex, right? So I did have those thoughts. You know, like, if I'm going to be very honest, like, when we were thinking about kids, before they were born, I thought, well, I know we don't get to choose these things. I know anything can happen. You know, even if you start with typically developing babies at birth, right? Things happen like within a few months, a few years, or much later. My mom, you know, lost her son, my brother, when he was only 25, right? So, like, I know very well, like, anything can happen. But when we were thinking about, did we want to keep going? One of my thoughts is, well, you know, to be honest, like, if I had a choice, I was like, I think I'd rather, like, not have kids than, like, have a medically complex child.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's very different now because right. They're here and they're amazing and they're perfect. And but when you're not in it and it's not real to you, right, it's like, it's easy to, like, think, oh, yeah, I would like to order, you know, two healthy kids, like, or one healthy kid, right?
No, totally. And I love that you shared that, because I think that's one of those thoughts that, like, I don't want to tell anyone that, especially because you're like, nah, I don't feel that way anymore. But, like, I appreciate that honesty, because I think that a lot of us have had that thought of, like, it feels like cringy to even say, but it's like almost like having a medically complex child is like the worst case scenario. And I think we see that reflected in society as well. Like, people see us with our kids and they're like, wow, that's my worst nightmare. And then we can be like, well, it's really hard, but, like, obviously, like, you love that child so much and you feel so grateful for them. So it feels very different than how you started out. But it's super interesting that, like, that was your thought of, like, this is worth it to keep going and stuff and, like, keep trying for these babies. But I think I'd rather just, like, not even have any kids than have one that has medical complexities. And then just to, like, feel your perspective shift, you know, once you actually are in that situation. Also, what you brought up too of, like, everything's gone wrong that could possibly go wrong. And so, like, here's, like, the one last thing that could go wrong. And, you know, what if that happens too? Because I think we all are familiar with that mindset too of, like, we're in that rare population of, like, the thing that they tell you statistically is unlikely happens to us. You know, it can be like everything has gone wrong, so the rest of everything will.
Yeah, exactly. I talked to the Prader-Willi community is amazing and so strong. And so, like, I immediately got a phone call. Like, when we got the diagnosis, a couple of people told me to check out this website. It's Prader-Willi USA. And, like, if you go online, you, like, fill out, like, a new parent to be contacted. And, like, the next day, I got a phone call from their, like, outreach, like, person. It was amazing to connect with her because she, like, told me right away, like, you're going to be okay. Like, Kenzie's going to be okay. Sophie's going to be okay. Like, yes, there's a lot of scary things on the internet about our diagnosis. But, you know, there's a lot of, like, treatments and therapies that really will make a difference.
Yeah, totally. What was that like when she reached out to you and told you, like, it's going to be okay?
It's definitely a game changer to have someone tell you, like, right away that rare disorders are not updated on the internet. I looked at all the, like, references that I use, like, in my practice. It was all doom and gloom, you know, in terms of, like, the kind of lives that our kids are going to have. I'm so, like, grateful. Because I connected with a few people right away. So, like, my friend connected me with her friend who is an endocrinologist who sees some Prader-Willi kids in her practice. So she also told me, and this is, like, a few hours after getting the diagnosis, she was able to tell me, hey, you know what, like, most of my kids are so happy and they're doing so well. And, like, you know, I really think Kenzie's going to be okay. And I mean, that's, like, I mean, I think that's everything, right, that you want to hear is that your kid's going to be okay. Even though, like, I was starting to realize that okay is going to look a little bit different potentially than what we originally thought, you know, okay would be. Christy, like, activated this whole other network. So they're like, I got to assign, like, a local PWS mentor who lives in just a few towns away from me. And, like, she called me the next day and said, we're going to be okay. Yeah. So I'm really, like, so, so grateful that all of these, like, Prader-Willi parents reached out to me immediately, because that's what I needed to hear, you know?
But I think in, like, those early, like, especially when you just found out the diagnosis, or, you know, for people who don't have a diagnosis, when you first find out something's going on, like, I think that it does feel so not okay. We feel so not okay. I mean, like, okay is such a funny word because it's a very vague thing, but we all know what we're talking about here. Like, even just like the baseline of like, life will actually be good in a lot of ways. It'll be hard, you know, obviously, but like, there's so much goodness there that can look very different. But I just think it's really interesting that that's what the message you were receiving was, and that that is what you needed. Like, just tell me we'll be okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want anyone to lie to me, right? I want honesty too. But yeah, I was really grateful that with this diagnosis and this community, I was able to hear that pretty early on.
Yeah. What was that like too, like on the flip side of that? So you were hearing like, you know, she's going to be okay, you'll be okay. How old were they at this point? And like, what were the emotions you were experiencing and your partner as well?
So they were 2 weeks old. When Kenzie and Sophie were born, both of them had like great Apgar scores immediately. And then Kenzie just, you know, she basically went like floppy and limp and wasn't moving, wasn't crying. And so that's when she got moved to the NICU immediately. Fortunately, she was very stable. Still very scary that we didn't know what was going on with her, and she wasn't able to feed with a bottle. They were giving her NG tube feeds. And then they were, you know, doing different tests, and like everything was pretty much coming back normal, which is great news. But then it was also like, but what is going on? And, you know, like sometimes no news is good news, right? But then like they started running different tests and kind of escalating their workup. And then we got the call 2 weeks later that one test came back for Prader-Willi syndrome. We had no like signs and symptoms until she like was born. So it took us like about 2 weeks to get the diagnosis, which, you know, was fast, right? Which I'm grateful for that we were able to get that information. But it did like kind of ruin the, like, I feel like those 2 weeks I was like, I really was very intentional. And this is like something I learned because of all the mindfulness I had to train up to survive our IVF journey. It's not something I like did on my own by any means, but I was very intentional about like, okay, I don't want to look back on this time and just be like, oh my God, it was so traumatic, and remember nothing but the trauma, you know, which I think can happen. And it's very valid to experience like the beginning of your child's life that way, especially when you're in the NICU and, you know, there's like all these things happening. But because I'd had this training, I was like, okay, you know, I want to make sure that I really enjoy and celebrate, because it is amazing that these babies are finally here. And so really trying to be grounded, and when I was with them, just, you know, enjoy them and love them, and just like really like focus on like gratitude and love and joy. But then also, you know, take the time that I needed absolutely to like also be like, I'm scared, I don't know what's going on, this is really like intense. So I felt like when I was like those 2 weeks, though, I did feel like I was pretty good about like, let's just focus on what we know and not focus on what we don't know. Let me focus on like what I can do for her, right? And not all the things that I can't do. So that was just, you know, loving her and not like kind of spiral into the what ifs. And so I feel like sometime during the second week, I was able to have more peace around like, okay, you know what, like, we're going to be okay. Like, whatever it is, you know, if it's nothing, that'd be amazing. If it's something, we'll be okay. By the way, that wasn't really the reaction that I had when we got the diagnosis. It was more like frantically Googling, crying, a lot of crying, and then trying to process and like talk to my people, talk to my best friends, my ride or dies, who I felt really safe talking to and saying every dark thought to them. And I did talk to Ray, of course, but, you know, I did feel like I had to be mindful of how intense I was with my emotions around him, because he was also processing and grieving too. It kind of ruined that little like nice little bubble where everything was like safe, because we didn't know exactly what was going on, right? Somebody shared this quote recently and I thought it was great. Having a diagnosis does not change your child or the love you have for him. It gives you more information to allow you to be the best mom you can be for him. So I saw that quote recently and it definitely connected to that. We have this diagnosis, which gives us like, I know exactly how to advocate for her, right? And I connected with this community.
Well, it's like it gives you like this roadmap, right? Which is really awesome in so many ways. Like you said, like, especially when you have like some substantial community there and like, you know, research and things. But I think it's also like the roadmap can be great because it's helpful and it gives you the information and everything. But it's also like, I don't want to be on that. You know, I don't want to do that. That map is like less desirable or like not what I pictured for my life. And so I think, you know, it can go both ways. It's like, it's great to have this information because it helps us do what we need to do, but I don't want to do it. So I think there can be like that duality of like intense grief as well as like gratitude for the information that we can gain from that.
Yeah, when we got the diagnosis, and you know, there was definitely a lot of intense grieving and sadness, and like grieving the life we thought that Kenzie was going to have and the life that we thought we were going to have with Kenzie. And I think like all of my previous experiences did give me this like little bit of insight, even in like my very like depths of like all the despair. And I didn't know, I was like, I know we can do this. Like, I know we can do this. Like, we spent, you know, 7 years really like fighting and advocating for me and Ray to like basically make these two babies. And I was like, okay, I know that we can also like spend the rest of our lives like also fighting and advocating for them and to make sure that they have the best life possible. But even though I know I can do this, I was like, I don't want to. Like, even before we got the diagnosis, my husband turned to me and was like, why can't anything just be easy for us? Every step of the way, it's always been something. And now it's a rare genetic disorder.
Yeah. And you mentioned too before that like, it was also difficult to like see your friends and family members move on with life and have the children. And you were like, oh, when's it going to be my turn? And then finally it's your turn. And then now to feel still kind of on the sidelines a bit, or like on the outside looking in of like, you have the typically developing kids. We have this complex situation and we're still not experiencing what they have. Like, how has that affected your relationships?
So I've been talking about IVF for a few years, pretty openly with almost everybody and anyone. And with my friends that I feel like they have the capacity to hear feedback from me, I've been pretty specific and clear about what is the best way for them to support me. And so I feel like with this diagnosis and all the things that came with it, I do feel like a good number of my friends understood what kind of support I was looking for. So I found that really helpful. And also, when I shared my diagnosis, I included a quote by Adam Grant, which basically talks about how I'd like to be supported. And that is to really just be there for me and validate my feelings. And so I think like this also helped the people in my life understand what I needed at that time. But I will say, you know, the first 5 months of Kenzie and Sophie's life, I cried every day. And I definitely am very grateful that I gave myself that time to process and grieve. And that's how I needed to do it. And so I definitely felt like in that time, it was harder for me to hear and see friends that were, you know, having babies that weren't going to the NICU, or they were traveling with their children and they were doing the things that I thought that I would be doing. You know, now that I'm finally here, now that I finally have my children, all the things that I thought we'd be doing. And some of these things we can do, maybe, but some of them we might not be able to and we just don't know. And so when I was in those 5 months, there was definitely a lot of like self-pity and just like feeling like, okay, we're not going to get to do all the things that everyone else can do again. I think for me, it was more about thinking about the future, because I did envision like if we had like one, I would love to be the parent that traveled with their, you know, infants. But I think having twins, I think the travel would have been a lot harder. Traveling with twins seems like a lot. So I don't know if we would have done that, even if both of them were typically developing.
Yeah. Well, it seems like the twin aspect of it has kind of muted some of those differences or comparisons. Cause like you say, like, well, traveling with twin babies, like that's going to be really hard too, right? So it's not just the diagnosis, but you've probably thought of this, like as they grow up, it'll probably also emphasize, you know, those differences a lot too, because you'll watch, okay, here's like a typically or non-disabled child growing up next to their disabled sibling and really seeing those differences side by side and seeing the different milestones, you know, and the differences there. I mean, that's got to be just such an interesting, to put it lightly, situation to have.
Yeah, like even from the very beginning, right? Like we got to go home with Sophie after like 2 nights in the hospital, and then we had to leave Kenzie in the NICU, and that was super heartbreaking to have to do that. And then to like, you know, be at home where like it's familiar and it's like comfortable, right? And then like to go to the NICU and to visit Kenzie, and my husband and I had talked about like how there's kind of a long path to get from the parking to, you know, the hospital, and it felt like we were kind of walking into this like alternate world or universe.
Yeah. So I had Wendy, who's non-disabled, and then Kimball. And I think because of that, it intensified my grief more than maybe it would have if Kimball were my first, just because I was like, I know how it's supposed to be. And so to literally be living that at the same time, right, these parallel universes, to be like, it's not fair that Kenzie doesn't get to experience what Sophie is. Like, that's not fair. I can literally, I'm experiencing at the same time, like, these two differences of experiences and realities, that it's not equal and it's not fair.
Yeah, exactly.
When Kenzie finally came home, you know, of course, amazing and wonderful to have her home. That was the best, because it was it took us a long time, and it was actually pretty challenging getting her home. But yeah, it's just, we see how, like, for example, like feeding from a bottle, like Sophie just picked it up pretty early, right? And she just started doing it, like typically developing babies do. And then for Kenzie, like, she and me and my family and our feeding therapist, we've been working so hard for, like, basically the last, like, year for her to, like, do this. And she works so hard, we work so hard, you know, and she's doing amazing. But, you know, just to see, like, for Sophie to sit up, you know, like, she just one day started doing it. And I see Kenzie working so hard for months and months and months to do the same thing that Sophie does. I think I can easily focus on, like, sadness there. But most of the time I focus more on, like, they're both amazing and they're both doing things in their own time frame.
Yeah. When I think, like, the grief that you've experienced before they were born, that does, like you say, like, it gives a very different perspective too, where, like, you were longing for these children for so long. And it just does add, like, this perspective and this gratitude that maybe you wouldn't have been able to have if you'd had them right away when you were 30 and not had to go through all of the IVF process beforehand and really wanting these kids.
Yeah, I think it would have been a very different experience. Whether or not we had a rare disorder, I think, like, it would have been a very different experience if I had had kids, like, back when we started trying when I was 32. I was definitely a different person then. And I just have a lot more awareness around my emotions. And, like, I have a lot more, like, acceptance around, like, you know, you can't control anybody or anything except for yourself and your emotions. You know, you read that and most people intellectually, they're like, yeah, of course, I know that. That makes sense. But to actually practice it, right, and really emotionally connect with that is, like, not something that I did until our IVF journey, like, kind of forced me to, like, train up that kind of, like, awareness around that idea. And so I think that's really powerful to go into parenthood, whether or not you have a medically complex child. I think that's really, like, powerful. That's kind of allowed me to accept that, like, okay, you know, we have this diagnosis and Kenzie's currently has these challenges, but she will be able to make progress and move past them. And all we can do is do the best we can to push her and support her and be okay with that.
Yeah, I really like that. I think that's such a healthy mindset to have. I'm, like, sitting here thinking, like, not to, like, minimize what you went through, but, like, I had Kimball when I was 24. I felt so young because I was so young. So I'm just like, man, I do think that is definitely a tool that you're able to bring into that, like, your wisdom and your life experience, and not just life experience, but experience with really hard stuff. I think that that's really cool that you were equipped with that going into it. And I also want to make sure we talk about this too. I would love to hear how your profession has influenced your parenting, and, like, just the good, the bad, the ugly. Like, how has that impacted your parenthood?
So I'm an integrative family medicine physician. So family medicine, I think most people are familiar with, right? I treat, like, basically newborns and then all age groups. But my specialty is more integrative medicine. So this is, like, trying to look at the body as a whole and trying to see if we can figure out, you know, other causes of whatever symptom or disorder that hasn't been, like, addressed. And as much as possible, really trying to, like, basically support the body's ability to heal itself. I will use things that are a little bit more outside the box thinking, because there aren't any other options, right? And so we have a couple of, like, PWS specialists that are part of our team. And when I first met with them, they basically said a lot of the same things that I very much am aligned with when it comes to health and wellness. So they said food is medicine. And they also said, like, hey, you know, if you, like, hear about, like, something that you want to try, like, you know, say you read in a Facebook group or something and you want to try it, like, let me know. I'm really open. And she said, if we wait for the FDA to approve of treatments, you know, it'll be too late. And so these are two things I've, like, never heard another physician outside of, like, the ones that practice the way I do say. And so I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, the rare disease world specialists actually very much speak the same language that I do, you know, when it comes to, like, approaching health and wellness. So that was, like, pretty cool for me to, like, realize that, you know, I did have some like-minded physicians on our team.
To directly answer your question about the good and the bad and the ugly of being a physician, I don't think there's anything bad or ugly about being a physician when you have a medically complex child. I've never been more grateful that I chose this profession. And it was a struggle for me to get into medical school and then to finish and then to finish my residency and all my training. So I've never been so grateful that like I kept going and I pushed myself through all those years because like, yeah, I can't imagine how dramatically harder my life would have been, you know, to do IVF and to navigate my endometriosis without being a physician and how much harder it would be for me to advocate and navigate having a medically complex child in the NICU. So yeah, it's pretty freaking awesome. And it definitely makes my role as the parent of a medically complex child, you know, dramatically easier.
Definitely is a huge advantage when it came to like advocating for her in the hospital and then outside the hospital too.
Yeah. Like what were those conversations like? Like when you were able to use the language and like, that sounds so amazing. For me, I was so inexperienced with like the medical world that like they would use these acronyms and I was like, I don't even know what you're talking about. And so, I mean, do you feel like they treated you differently than like your husband? I'm assuming he doesn't have medical background.
Yeah, he works in tech. So we were never there at the same time, right? Because like one of us would be at home with Sophie. So it was very infrequent that we would be there together. So I can't say like I witnessed this myself, but he says they did. Like for a period of time, they were recommending that we get a G-tube. That's definitely very appropriate that they were recommending it. And for some Prader-Willi families, that's what they decide is best for them. But the Prader-Willi like specialists do recommend that, you know, if the families can manage it, to do an NG-tube if possible. So yeah, he likes to tell the story about how like one day one of the doctors came by and was like, all right, let's talk about a G-tube. And then he was like, hold up, let me get my wife on the phone. And then when he called me, he said that her choice of words and like tone was a little bit more different. We were pretty consistent with our message, I think, at that point that we wanted to go home with an NG-tube.
Which really quick, just in case there's anyone, I don't know that there would be, but in case there's anyone who's like not sure about the difference, NG goes through your nose. There's no surgery needed for that. And then a G-tube goes right into their stomach. So it's like an invasive surgery that you open a hole, just to put that out there.
Yeah, thank you. That's the example he likes to give where, you know, it sounded like the doctor was more like intentional with him and direct about like, let's talk about it. Let's do this. Versus with me, it was more like, okay, how do you feel about this? And then, yeah, absolutely. Like through the Rare Life community and discussion groups, which, yes, they're amazing. I've met so many different moms who have so many different challenges. And most of us have like totally different disorders. And I'm so amazed because like it was already so intense for me and my husband, right? And like all the emotions and like the fear and like not knowing and then processing. And then in addition, right, to have to like, fortunately for me, like, you know, we didn't have to learn a whole new language, right? But when you are like a medical parent, if you're not in healthcare, right, you do have to learn a whole new language. And I'm always in awe with all the parents that are like learning how to like communicate with their medical team. They're learning about how the body works. They're learning about how all these procedures work. So yeah. So for me, absolutely. Like there's definitely things like, you know, a specialist would say something to me like Prader-Willi syndrome. I had learned about it in med school, but probably just a couple lines about it. And I had no idea what it was, you know? So there are definitely things I like have to either look up or ask them to explain to me, but still, you know, like definitely like hugely an advantage to be able to speak the same languages as my doctors. I'd imagine that it's also a lot easier for them, right? Because they know that they can just like speak to me. Mm-hmm. They can use all the medical terminology and they know like most likely I'll follow along. And if I don't follow along, I'll tell them. So
it's interesting because I've heard from parents too, like, and I've done this where going into appointments, like parents without a medical background, where they'll go to appointments being kind of like dressed up, like, right? Like you're kind of like flexing a little bit, like I need to be taken seriously. I need to like look professional. And then I've heard parents over there like, I, you know, have a master's and so I'll like drop that, casually bring it up in the conversation. They're like, they take me more seriously when they find out that I'm educated. And there's also like racial biases there too and gender stereotypes. And so I think it's, you know, in advocating for our kids, there can be so many, it's just kind of loaded. Like there's just a lot of things that can come up against us. And I just love that, not to like minimize like, you know, the things that are hard and that have been hard for your journey, but I love that like you came into this experience equipped with, you know, the mindfulness skills like you talked about and like the grit of like, I know I can do really hard things. And like this medical background, I think that is such a great combo to make you just a really great parent for Kenzie and Sophie.
Yeah, it's been a lot, right? And it's been super hard, even with all these advantages I've had and privileges I've had, that's been super hard. But yeah, absolutely. Like I definitely recognize that, like, the timing of when these babies showed up in my life and all the challenges that come with being their parent, like, I have all the tools I need to be, like, a really awesome parent to them and, like, to do everything I can to give them a great life.
I love that.
Being a physician, like, doctors are human too, right? And they all bring their, even though, like, we're trained not to have biases, right? But we do. And I know that everyone's doing the best that they can and they're really trying to do their best to serve everybody. But because of that, you know, I'd imagine that, like, as, like, my husband witnessed, right? Like, that's why he got treated a little bit differently than I did. And also at the end of the day, it was still really hard for us. Like, we were kept in the hospital for a long time because our team wasn't comfortable sending us home with an NG tube versus a G tube. It was also partially because Kenzie, she was eating a very, very small percentage. And so, you know, they would have felt more comfortable if she was eating like a much higher percentage. And then our hospital wasn't connected with like the official outpatient NG tube program to like follow up. Versus like some of the other hospitals, like the other children's hospitals in the area do have that. And so they wanted us to be transferred to another hospital that had the program. And then we'd have that like follow-up setup, which is fair. I get that. And because we were in the middle of a really bad like RSV, COVID, flu season, like the worst RSV season we'd seen in years, you know, like all the hospitals were full. It is what it was. But I basically set up my own outpatient NG tube team. I got like a GI appointment. I got like an appointment with the Prader-Willi clinic. And then I was like, okay, and if we have an emergency, like there's this like urgent care that's like can like replace the tube for us in case we can't do it. But they were still like not comfortable with that. So I guess my point is just like being a physician, like, definitely gave me a lot of like tools and resources. And like I knew exactly how to like advocate for her. But in the end, it's not enough, right? Obviously, it's still their decision. And so I'm not the physician for my child, obviously.
Well, it probably feels so different when it's like your own child and you're in parent mode, right? You know, flipping the table completely would feel really interesting. I hope that like my comment didn't sound like minimizing. I did not mean to be like, oh, Annie, you've got it like so good. Like,
oh,
that
no,
must
no.
not have been hard at all. That's not what I meant. So I acknowledge like lots of hard stuff.
This kind of falls into like, you can say that to me, right? Because you're another like rare disease parent, right? But like, if you don't have that experience, then like, it hits a little differently when someone tells me that. You know what I mean?
Like, oh, you're so lucky.
Yeah, I definitely got that a lot. And I know people have like the best intentions. They're like, you know, like, oh, wow, she's so lucky to have you as a mom. Or like, yeah, we know she's going to be okay because she has you as a mom. And I'm like, it's not like these statements, like, they don't bother me. I'm not saying that. But it's different when another rare disease parent says that to me. I'm like, yes, I know, you know exactly. Versus, you know, like someone who hasn't had the experience, it's a little different. It's part of that, like, you know, that ring theory. I was thinking about that recently where it's like, you know, where like the person in crisis, right, can like dump out and then each person that's like further away from that like crisis, like ideally they would only offer like comfort, right, and not like dump on you.
Yeah, like complain to the outer circles that are not as close to the center of like the crisis. So it would be like your parents or your mom could complain to like her sister, right? Or like someone else like that. But for her to be like, oh, Annie, this is so hard for me, would be a little more like off-putting. Like, well, I'm the one going, you know, I'm the mom. So
yeah. So not exactly the same thing that you were describing. But, you know, people that are like in it too, in their own like rare disease, medically complex world too. Like when they say things like that, like what you said to me, I'm like, yes, I know you really understand. Versus like the people that have not had the experience. And again, not that it's offensive to me or triggering for me, but I'm like, I know that it doesn't resonate with them the way that it resonates for me and other rare disease parents, right? So
it also goes back to the fact that like what you said earlier of like, oh, when you were picturing your family and like maybe we wouldn't have more kids if we knew they'd have medical issues and stuff. Like no matter what credentials someone has or life experience, like nothing truly can prepare you for having your child be the one, you know, that's going through this kind of thing. And so I think no matter what, whether you're 24 and totally inexperienced with medical stuff or a physician and older and have more experience, like I think you never really are prepared for that or parenthood in general either.
Yeah. Like, you know, when I was like thinking about all the challenges of parenting and as we were going through our IVF and as things kept like getting harder and harder when we were doing our like, okay, like why do we want to have children and like do we want to keep going? Like, and when I thought about all the hard things about parenting, then like, am I ready to like take on all of it? You know, obviously I didn't think about, oh, but what if we have like a really medically complex child who has a rare disorder? Or, I mean, you know, intellectually I knew that those are things that are possible, but I didn't spend a lot of time really like thinking about it. Because before this, I didn't really know anybody that had you know, rare disorders or like likely complex children. And so it was like, okay, you know, like it's not something I really thought about would happen to us.
Yeah, totally. Well, Annie, just to wrap up, I know you've shared so much wisdom, but like what's one thing you would like to leave with listeners in this community from your experience of like working on mindfulness and the things that you've learned from going through really hard things already and already experiencing grief? What is like the number one thing that you've held on to that's helped you get through all of this?
I think like what's really helped us through all the challenges so far is that like I feel like I was really forced to like get really good at like processing bad news, you know? So I learned when we had cycles that didn't go well or transfers that failed or like we had miscarriages, like eventually I learned like, okay, here are all the things I need to do to like kind of like process the bad news. So that's something that I think has been really helpful for me just for life in general. And as like a parent to a medically complex child, having a process for like processing bad news. So for me, it's a very much like one is to like talk about it. I need to talk about it and I need to like sit in my emotions and I need to feel it. And I have a few friends that are just like very safe to me and I know I can say whatever I want to them, you know? And so really giving myself that time to like cry and like say all the things and just like get it out of my system. And so I think that's been huge. I feel like I didn't do that in my 20s and that's what led to like I had challenges with depression, you know? So I think that this is why like in my 40s is when I realized like, okay, this is my process and this is what I need to do. So crying, the talking, the like really sitting with my emotions and feeling it all and giving myself that time and space and grace, right, to feel it. And then that's also like a little bit of like healthy distraction. You know, sometimes it's just nice to like watch like a fun, lighthearted TV show, right, to kind of just like not think about all the intense emotions for a period of time. So for us, it was like Ted Lasso and Shrinking were the shows that were like out at the time. And then it is like the next step for me is like, okay, and then like thinking about what can we do? It's not like it happens like 1, 2, and 3. They often all happen at the same time. But I do feel like for me, all those three pieces need to happen to like, you know, kind of get past that really intensely sad, traumatic phase of like, you know, grieving and processing bad news. And then the other thing that I have found the most helpful is I think anybody with a very busy, full, demanding life, right, whether you're a parent or not, or whether you're like have a medically complex child or not, right, I think that we all tend to like go through our days in this like kind of like a low grade or sometimes it's a higher grade state of like fight and flight, right? So like our nervous system is like highly activated and like our stress hormones are like super high, you know, like our shoulders, our neck, our jaws, our stomachs, everything is like clenched and tight, right? This is like a really normal response, right? Because like most of us were like juggling so many things. We're doing 20 things at the same time and thinking about the next 20 things, right? Mm-hmm. And for a lot of like, especially in the medically complex world, right? A lot of us, it's like life or death. Like fortunately for us, Kenzie has always been stable. But, you know, I know that there's a lot of families out there that they're constantly in and out of the hospital and they're constantly getting procedures done, right? It's definitely very valid and normal like for your body to like be in this fight and flight response. But what I find really helpful is that like, and this took me like years to get good at this. So this is not something I'm saying like I did overnight. But what I've gotten really good about is like when I have those days, right? And it's definitely more often than not now where there's just so much going on and I have so many things to juggle. I really like try to like check in with my body throughout the day and really try to like take a deep breath and like relax my shoulders and like maybe like relax my body. And I think just like these little adjustments that I'm constantly making, they like take my nervous system just slightly down a little bit. And I, you know, end up being a little bit more grounded. And I find that these little like micro adjustments really like by the end of the day, like I think back on like before I started doing these exercises where I would just be like totally wiped out. And sometimes I am still totally wiped out, but I do feel like those days where I feel like totally overwhelmed and just kind of like really burnt out, like they don't happen as often as they would have if I didn't have that like tool. This is something I often recommend too in my practice because I'm like, this doesn't take any time to do, right? Sure, I'd love to go sit and do like a daily 20-minute meditation, but it's hard to make that time for that, right? And so I love that, like, I love this practice because like, it takes no time. I can do it while I'm doing other things, right? And it's just these little like adjustments in your body and your nervous system. Even if like the next moment you have something crazy happen, these little adjustments still kind of get your nervous system a little bit more grounded. So, you know, by the end of the day, instead of being up here, you're kind of down here now. So I think that for me, like in the day-to-day, that's been really huge. Obviously, I recognize that like, trying to ground yourself and relaxing your body and take deep breaths, it's not going to give Kenzie a normal chromosome, right? It's not going to take away her feeding tube, but it makes it easier for me to like every day, like be the best version of myself.
Another action that was really invaluable for my mental health and my healing process has been finding my community. So I want to say, like, in my, like, 5 months of crying every day, sometime around, like, month four is when I felt like I was ready to start taking more action. And, you know, I could move past just the, like, the day-to-day responsibilities, but also move past, like, the daily crying. And this is when I started reaching out to different, like, virtual support groups. And then, conveniently, this is when the Rare Life launched their discussion groups. So, of course, I immediately signed up to participate. And then the rest is history, right? I met a lot of amazing people through the Rare Life community. For me, it's just, like, talking to other people who get it, other people who are really safe, even doing things like this, like sharing my story with you, Madeline, and this podcast and this community. It's just so healing, right? And being validated by people who get it is just so healing.
Yeah, I really love those. I think that's so great. I think it's applicable to every person listening right now because it's things that we can do, very accessible. Yeah, I'm so grateful for your sharing your story and, you know, all the different parts that went into that and the unique perspectives that you have. Thank you so much for being on today.
Yeah, thank you too. Thank you so much for having me. And also, obviously, thank you again for supporting this community. I feel like every time I have a question that I'm curious about, I will, like, look to your podcast and, you know, find the episode and learn so much, or even questions that I haven't thought about. There's just been so many valuable tips that I've learned, like, you know, like managing the NG tube and traveling with an NG tube, like, and then obviously the community too that you've built. It's been really amazing to connect with all these different, like, strong parents that really understand exactly what I'm going through. So thank you too.
Oh, thank you so much. You can connect with Annie and me on social media by checking out the links in the show notes. We are the_rare_life on Instagram and the Rare Life Podcast on Facebook. A huge thank you to Annie for this beautiful episode and to my right-hand woman, Alyssa, for doing the post-production and promotion for this episode. Another huge thank you to Functional Formularies for sponsoring this episode. You can find more information about them at functionalformularies.com. And one last plug to participate in our annual family and friends fundraiser. We are counting on you to help us receive the funding we need to cover our operating costs and to get the podcast to more ears. You can find all the details on therarelife.org/fundraiser. And as a reminder, if you are interested in joining our discussion groups, you can sign up in the link in the show notes. Join me next week for an episode from the perspective of siblings of medically complex children. The majority of the contributors are 12 years old and under. It is equal parts heartbreaking, heartwarming, and enlightening. Don't miss it. See you then.